Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
Investors, developers, and local communities make long-term decisions based on the assumption that a federal permit means a project can move forward. Critics of a little-used EPA authority argue that assumption may no longer be as reliable as many people think. Joining the Federal Drive to walk through the issue, Myron Ebel, chairman of the Fix the EPA Veto Coalition.
This is a fascinating topic. We hear a lot about permitting and how slow government permitting is, and this administration has made faster permitting one of its key tenets. But you're talking about EPA Section 404C. Talk to me about what that authority is and where it fits in the larger permitting debate.
Under the Clean Water Act, the Army Corps of Engineers does the environmental permitting for projects that require dredge and fill permits. So anything that moves dirt or rock, especially over wetlands. So things like pipelines, mining projects, other infrastructure, these all require a permit. And that's what the Trump administration is trying to speed up and get projects approved faster and with less complicated environmental impact statements. Congress, of course, is trying to pass permitting reform, but that's blocked in the Senate. But there's one thing that the Trump administration is leaving out or overlooking, and that is the fact that the EPA can veto these Army Corps of Engineer permits under Section 404C of the Clean Water Act. Not only during the permitting process, they can veto those projects after they have been approved, permitted, and are in construction. So this is a huge threat to investors and companies that want to build multi-billion dollar projects.
Walk me through how this is different from the normal environmental permitting process. A lot of people will be familiar with NEPA. Takes a long time to do and delays the start of projects. This feels different.
It is, because normally when you're issued a permit at any level of government under any statute, once that project is permitted, you have a permit and can go ahead. Now, of course, that permit could be canceled if you violate the terms, if you don't follow what you've agreed to. But under the Clean Water Act, there's this odd thing that Congress was very sloppy, I believe, in writing it back in the early 1970s, which they didn't set any limits on when EPA can veto the project. So it can be at any point, even after the investments have been made and the construction workers are on the ground and the project is being built. So this kind of regulatory uncertainty is just a huge disincentive to investors and companies to go through the long NEPA process to get a permit. It hasn't been used. People say, well, it's only been used once or twice. That's true. But as we see the environmental movement gaining more and more control over the Democratic Party and becoming more and more radicalized against fossil fuels in particular, we can see that, they've only used it once in the Obama administration, but it doesn't take using it very many times to drive out investment in all the other projects. So if a new administration came in and we had somebody who is of the wing of, a Senator Whitehouse or AOC as the EPA administrator, they could quickly retroactively veto a couple of projects, and then who else would even start the process? It just American investors are not stupid. They want to be able to make money after they get their project, after they've risked all this money. They want to be able to make money, not say, oh, well, you've already committed $500 million, but sorry, and you've got the permit, but now we're going to veto the project and you're left sitting on your hands.
Myron Ebel is senior advisor to the Fix the EPA Veto Coalition. This issue is playing out on the ground in Alaska right now at the Pebble Mine. Walk us through kind of what's happening.
The Pebble Mine, the story, which I've been involved in for, seems like decades now. The Pebble Project is a huge copper, gold, molybdenum, rare earths, and other things mine. It's a massive deposit. Interestingly, it's the Trump administration that has gone along with the opposition and has tried to block it. But they haven't exercised a retroactive veto on it. They're contesting the permit in court. The company has appealed the denial of the permit by the Army Corps of Engineers, and the company is in court. Now, let's assume that the court decides that the Army Corps of Engineers has to issue the permit, that the environmental impact statement was adequate, and they've invested $150 or $200 million in all the studies. And then the Trump administration or a future administration could then veto the project even after all these decades of effort by the company to get the mine off the ground or in the ground.
The EPA and environmental groups might say this authority exists precisely because some of these projects later pose extraordinary risk. Why shouldn't the agency retain that backstop, or is there some other process that you would recommend as a remediation should environmental issues occur after the permitting process?
Some of your listeners probably have more expertise on this than I do, but I believe that permits, once they're issued, have to be honored by both parties. So if the builder of a project violates the terms of that permit, then it should it could be canceled or modified. But I don't quite understand this argument about new threats coming up. I think the argument really is, well, this administration didn't adequately consider the climate impacts of fossil fuel emissions, and therefore now we're going to apply that. Well, I'm sorry, that bus has already left. If the project has been permitted after all of the authorities and all the litigation that goes on with any big permit have decided that the climate impacts are not sufficient to block the project, then they can't decide later, oh, but we've changed our mind. Those impacts are so dire that we have to cancel it. I just don't get that. I think if the public decides that greenhouse gas emissions are a problem, then Congress can change the laws and we can go on a fossil fuel diet. Up until that time, I don't think we're going to do it.
If the administration and Congress agreed with you about how to fix the EPA veto, what specific changes would provide more certainty here without eliminating environmental protections altogether?
Well, the best thing to do would be for Congress to change the law. But as you know, there's an impasse on anything like this in the Senate. So Chairman Mike Lee has to negotiate with Senator Heinrich and White House. And so I don't see Congress fixing it by actually doing what's in other statutes, which is if there is a veto authority, it has to have time limits and constraints and sideboards. So what the Fix the EPA Veto Coalition, of which I'm a senior advisor, is trying to do is to convince the Trump White House that this problem, this threat to investment in major infrastructure projects can be improved through the regulatory process. And this was actually undertaken. It was started in the first Trump administration by EPA, but it never got anywhere. And we think it's time to pick it up again and finish it, which is a new rule that sets limits on the veto authority. Now, you can say, oh, but a future administration could undo that rule. Yes, but that takes time. That can be litigated too. And in the meantime, the project can be, the projects that are at least in the pipeline that are being built can be finished and in operation. And then if the EPA wants to veto the, that project that's now in operation, they can then pay the company a very large sum of money to wind it up.
Do you have a sense that the EPA is going to take up that regulatory action?
I hope so, because it's I think it's fairly obvious. I don't think, you know, this is something that the energy and building community is very aware of, this threat, this huge regulatory uncertainty. And so I think we have a number of business associations and nonprofit groups that belong to the Fix the EPA Veto Coalition. And I hope that the White House and the EPA will recognize that, hey, they pointed out something that's obvious, and there's a lot of support for, I don't want to say fix it, because the Congress can do that, but improve it, put limits on it that would take some time for a future administration to undo.
Myron Ebel is a senior advisor to the Fix the EPA Veto Coalition. We'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts.
Sean O'Keefe, former Navy Secretary, NASA Administrator, and senior leader across multiple presidential administrations, reflects on the principles that shaped his long federal career. In this episode of Lessons in Leadership, he joins Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA, to discuss motivating teams through uncertainty, leading across agencies, and staying rooted in mission during times of public scrutiny and change.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today, I'm honored to be joined by Sean O'Keefe, former NASA Administrator, former Deputy Director of the Office of Management and Budget, former Secretary of the Navy, former Comptroller and CFO of the Defense Department, and Professor Emeritus at Syracuse University's Maxwell School of Public Affairs. Welcome. Welcome, and thank you for joining.
Well, thank you, Shane. Delight to be with you. Appreciate it very much.
What first drew you into public service, and when was it evident to you that leadership was an important part of the roles you played?
Well, I grew up around the public service. My dad was a career naval officer. He was a submariner, and we lived all over the place throughout the country. And as a result, I got an up close and personal understanding through him, as well as through all the folks he associated with and the environments he was working in, just what the extraordinary value is of public service and why, what is it that would motivate people to want to be engaged in it and to be really involving themselves in what is something larger than themselves. And the only place that that is really, you know, formulated properly is within the public sector and the public service, that again is the beneficiary or the beneficiaries are the citizens of the nation, the community, and the region in which you live.
Did you think about leadership early on, saying, I need to be a great leader, and therefore I'm going to learn how to do it? Or did you just naturally evolve into it? Any thoughts on that?
I guess it evolved by the great good fortune of being witness to several really extraordinary leaders, people who really did take the initiative to engage others in the task, to pull together and motivate folks to really contribute their very best to achieve an outcome. And I saw the value of that on multiple occasions and found that was the primary ingredient, the trait, the characteristic that needed to be exhibited is the fundamentals of leadership in moving everyone engaged towards a common objective.
You have served under several presidents. Can you talk a little bit about that? What were there challenges to overcome, or were you away from politics so you didn't get... talk about that a little bit. how does it differ as you serve through a transition, or is it does leadership stay the same?
Oh no, it's quite it's really critically important in transition cases, to be sure. But the two presidents that I served in their administrations were President George H.W. Bush and President George W. Bush, in two different eras, obviously. But as a consequence, that was the closest I came to understanding the nature of the individuals who were in that leadership, ultimate leadership capacity, and their capability to motivate. Both of them were just extraordinarily inspiring people who motivated everybody to be part of the solution. But most importantly, they also had a capacity of really designating what needed to be done. And you knew that they were perfectly prepared to do it themselves. And that made the task that much more achievable. There were several different circumstances in understanding what the objectives of the senior leadership are all about.
You've worked for different kinds of organizations, political administrations, and then, you know, government departments, agencies, and then private sector, and now academia. How does that affect your leadership style? Or do you find that leadership, the core tenets of leadership, are applicable no matter what the organization you find yourself in and having to lead? It doesn't matter where you are, that the core leadership characteristics are the same. Are they different? Are you adapting?
Well, there's a common myth, in my judgment, and I'm probably the minority view of this in the academic field of public management. That common myth is that you can't apply the same principles in the public sector that you do in the private sector.
Yeah.
I never found that to be an impediment.
Okay.
It was always a circumstance where, you know, strategy, the focus on the talent, people engaged, the process to going through decision making, the integrity imperative that must be there in order to demonstrate the absolute conviction of what's intended here, as well as the moral standing of what it is you're attempting to achieve. All those factors are very much the same. It's going to have its nuances, and there are very distinctive, you know, differentiators within those organizations and those sectors. But at the same time, those basic principles, those tenets, foundations of what make up organizations and organization theory, in so many ways are fundamentally the same. And how you employ those may be slightly nuanced to match the condition, but they all are imperative in the same direction.
A little bit of a different direction. You were part of the very first cohort of what is now Presidential Management Intern Program, later became the Presidential Management Fellows Program. What did that early experience teach you about leading within government?
The Presidential Management Intern Program, as it started, was designed for just that purpose, a focus on public management, a focus on implementation. And its evolution over time has been extraordinary. It mystifies me why that has been the subject now of an executive order that has dismantled it. And it's absolutely unconscionable given the nature of the hundreds, thousands of people who moved through that program in the course of the last nearly 50 years that have gone on in some cases to be senior executives within the federal government, and in other cases, they've moved on to other kinds of pursuits. But even with that, even for those who have left the service, they walked away with an appreciation of what public service is all about, why it matters, and why this is so critical to get it right. Because by and large, the reason why these functions are delegated to the public sector is because no one else can do it. Usually that's the case. It takes that kind of focus of a public entity in order to achieve an outcome that frankly would not be achieved in other spheres. So as a result of that, it gave me an incredibly in-depth understanding of that process at a very early stage in my career that has lasted the entirety of that professional experience.
A closing question. Who has influenced your leadership style, and what about their example stays with you? And that question can be cast broadly. So, you know, inside government, outside government, perhaps not government at all, somebody that you've met, reported to, been mentored by, a broad net. But when you think about broadly, when you think about who has influenced you, who comes to mind?
I would have to say that the number one, hands down, greatest influence during the course of my life was my dad. He was an engineer, so everything was a calculated risk. I think I was probably 25 before I realized the answer was not to be found for everything in a slide rule, but that was his bent and his mindset. And he taught me how to think critically. And it really was one of the most extraordinary attributes. And he was an inspiring parent who... and mentor in so many ways. And all the different things I've done throughout the course of his life, I had the opportunity through much of it to be able to consult with him on a variety of things, and always walked away with a more informed perspective. Ed was an extraordinary public servant in his own right.
Well, Sean, thank you very much for sharing your insights and experiences. It has been a pleasure talking.
I'm delighted to be with you, Shane. Thank you so much for doing this.
And this is Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA, reminding you to empower your team and embrace challenges. Until the next time on Lessons in Leadership.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.